So I had a read through of my talk description again, and I realized that it was actually just a little bit ambitious. So what I thought I'd do is today I'm going to talk about storytelling code and how play figures into that and how playing with media is going to help people develop new kinds of storytelling. And what I mean by the full stack of entertainment is everything from, you know, the entire experience design. So everything from the hardware to the software, from the software that you're using to actually create the entertainment that you're then publishing out into the real world. So first, I'll give you some context. I went to university. I was a lawyer, and I escaped, which is a very, very good thing. And then I went and I did two startups. I joined two startups, one of which was Mindcandy, where I worked on their first product, which was Perplex City, a very, very big alternate reality game, and they've since gone on to being stupendously successful with Moshi Monsters. And then I went off and did a startup with my brother called Six to Start, and we did things like We Tell Stories, which was a project that we did with Penguin Books about, you know, how do we define, how do we work out what net native storytelling is going to be. So we did stuff like We Tell Stories, we did a big education project with Channel 4 Education. And most recently, or about a year ago, I left the startup side and then went over to an ad agency, Wieden & Kennedy, and worked in London, then 4 months ago went out to Portland. So I've been a lawyer and I've jumped into advertising. So I'm probably not a very, very good person. What I want to talk to you, the first thing I'll talk to you about is this thing that happened to me back in 2001, which I hopefully will give you some context to where I'm coming from and what I'm about. I'm a bit of a geek. I can talk to developers and I can talk to kind of creative-y type people. And I feel like I'm in kind of a bit of a weird position because I can talk to developers and I know, you know, I can talk to them about architecture and stuff and implementation. But at the same time, I can talk to the writers that we worked with and all those weird creative people who work in advertising agencies. So the first thing that I want to talk about is storytelling. So we'll go back to 2001. And this is storytelling the hard way. So it's 2001. I'm busy not revising for my finals. And I'm reading Ain't It Cool News, which if you are a movie geek and a science fiction geek is probably something that you do quite a lot of. The trailer for Artificial Intelligence has just come out. It's a movie by Steven Spielberg based on a short story by Brian Aldiss. At some point, Kubrick was working on it. If John Gruber were here, then it would probably be his favorite movie. The trailer came out, and there was something interesting that was hidden at the very end of the trailer. There's this credit for this person called Janine Saller, who's a sentient machine therapist. And you're kind of like, well, I know what a director does, I know what Stan Winston does, but I don't really know what a sentient machine therapist is. If you're a geek and you are trying to not revise for your finals, that's kind of like crack. To the Google. So you Google Janine Saller, it turns out she's got her own website. It turns out that she actually teaches at Bangalore World University, which is not a real university. She's got a faculty page, you know, she began her research career as a graduate, blah, 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 motivation in artificial intelligence, all that kind of stuff. She's got a phone number and a email address, and I've got a Skype account. Do I have a Skype account? I can't remember. 2001, maybe I didn't have a Skype account and just spent a lot of money. I call her, and she wasn't in because she lives in the future. But I left a message for her. Maybe she'll ring me back in about 50 years. And then I could email her and I could get an auto response back. This all kind of went on and on. And the big deal about this was that there was this big story that was unfolding across all of these media. You know, they did real-world events. You could attend, like, anti-robot militia rallies and all that kind of stuff. There were fax machines that you could dial because people used those still in 2001. There were loads of puzzles for you to solve. And the big thing about it, the most wonderful thing about it, in spite of all the wonderful stuff in terms of discovering all the different things about how you'd get into the story and how you'd find out more about the world, and the way that it made the world feel more alive and as if it existed around you was that the writing was just really, really good. It was a really, really good story. You really cared about the characters and you actually wanted to know what happened next for them. And that was one of the most important things for me, because the guy who wrote it is a guy called Sean Stewart. And he's written, you know, very, very good books that have been New York Times bestseller rated, all that kind of stuff. But it's a collaboration between him and this chap called Ilan Lee, who was a game designer at Microsoft Game Studios. And you had these two guys. You had one, you know, hardcore coder, used to work at ILM, and you had this writer. And they got on amazingly. They had the best time. They still work together now. And you just knew that they felt that they'd found a new way of telling stories online that was all around the way that people discover and consume content on the net. And this was in 2001, so this was pre-YouTube, pre-Wikipedia, pre all of the Facebooks and MySpaces, and even probably before Orkut or Friendster, if anyone's still on Friendster. So this is the really hard way, because this required puzzles and live events and you know, tens and tens of websites and fax numbers and email autoresponders and all that kind of stuff. Lots of effort and hardly any automation as well. And you can contrast that with the easy way. So does anyone know, did anyone follow the Chicago mayoral election earlier this year? I know it's a very important topic, high on the list of people who live in the UK. But there was this Twitter account called Mayor Emmanuel, which was ostensibly Rahm Emanuel, who was one of the guys who was running for mayor. And I sincerely suggest that you go and you find it, because there's a guy, Tim Carmody, who writes on a blog called Snark Market, who kind of wrote all of this up. And there's also a great article on The Atlantic about this. And it's basically an alternate reality retelling. Like, there's this other Rahm Emanuel out there who basically swears his fucking head off the entire way through for about 5 months, 2,000 tweets worth, with this Malcolm Tucker-esque account of him going through the mayoral election of Chicago. And to the extent that The Atlantic feels that it's okay to say that it was the best fake Twitter account ever, deftly satirizing Rahm Emanuel and elevating the tweet and the F word to the level of literature. If you say that about the F word, it probably feels a bit like Malcolm Tucker and the thick of it. So that's the easy way. That's just doing it all on Twitter. And the second thing that I want to talk about is play. Andy by waxy.org. Ever know the waxy.org blog? He wrote this blog post just a few weeks ago. There'd been this new social sharing service that had been launched called Hilo, which was pretty much Twitter. And the one thing that, for some reason, people did with it when it got launched was that they set up fake accounts for everyone on it. So there was a fake Ev, there was a fake Mark Zuckerberg, there was a fake... There was an account called Social Media Consultant, who went round using all the buzzwords that you guys have been using in the hashtags all throughout this morning. It was absolutely fantastic. So you see, you've got Mark Zuckerberg's account here. Girls who say, I don't care what anyone thinks about me, sure spend a lot of time untagging themselves out of unflattering pics on Facebook. So it was saying a lot of fun stuff. And the nice thing about Hilo was that for that period of time, before they started deleting all these accounts, it was a place where people could pretend, and it was a place where people could play, and it felt like a very different place than Twitter. And then you contrast that with other, you know, wonderful Web 2.0 sites like Quora. So are there any Douglas Adams fans here? You're all geeks. You should all be putting your hands up. So everyone knows what Quora is. It's the Q&A site that was really, really big, and then now no one really talks about it. It's like that. It's the Q&A service that's in the corner that we're all kind of ignoring. And then people would eventually post questions like this. What is the answer to life, the universe, and everything? And predictably, everyone has a lot of fun with it because we're all geeks, and it's a West Coast kind of geeky thing, engineering thing. And then one of my friends posted this question. Why do you come here when you know what it makes Things hard for me when you know, oh, why do you come? Which I'm led to believe is a lyric from a piece of music. This is, apparently, this is not the type of question that you should be posting on Quora. Geeky science fiction references, yes. Indie music, no. So it's interesting that what we start to see is we start to see a distinction between platforms where it's okay to kind of mess around a bit. It's okay to kind of try and tell stories on them, and platforms where it's not. And also it's interesting when you start looking at the creation mechanisms, the authoring software. So the other thing about being able to play with stuff is that if a writer only ever gets to play with something like Microsoft Word for producing a manuscript, then you are always going to end up with something a bit like this. So it's not necessarily that let's tell a story that uses, you know, all the different abilities on a device like an iPhone. But, you know, what are the content creation mechanisms that we're using that allow us to create truly net native entertainment experiences? So the third thing that I said I'd talk about was code. And there was this wonderful quote from Eric Schmidt, who spoke at the Edinburgh TV Festival. He said very nasty things about Alan Sugar because we all love him and have Amstrad emailers in our home. Eric Schmidt said that in the 1980s, the BBC not only broadcast programming for kids about coding, but in partnership with Acorn, shipped over 1 million BBC microcomputers into schools and homes. And we all have very, very fond memories of stuff like this. Just a moment to appreciate it. And I think there's something really, really important in making sure that people are able to understand the medium. So we've got tools like If This Then That, which is kind of like an easier to use version of Yahoo Pipes, which is awesome, but a bit daunting. And the kind of big point that I'm trying to get at here, a friend of mine, Tom Armitage, wrote a blog post about this recently. It's that when you're trying to create with a medium, you really need to be able to play with it to understand it. You need to be able to understand the warp and the weft. And technology is not always a tool. It's an engineering substrate. It can be something to mold, to shape, and to sculpt with. And that's really, really important to what I see as being key to being able to create entertainment experiences that are native to the kind of networked environment that we live in now. So I said that I talk about the full stack of entertainment. First, a reprise. Last year, Tom Coates was here, and he gave this talk about everything the network touches. About ubiquitous network connectivity, about spimes, about networked cities. The thing that I'm interested in is what happens when that network starts touching the entertainment experiences that we create and the entertainment experiences that we consume and that we share with each other. This is the kind of stuff that we've seen so far. So the ad agency that I worked for last year, they did this campaign. The Old Spice guy, he does the thing with the diamonds, and it's funny. But when it comes down to it, it was a TV spot, right? It was a very well-written TV spot. It was like a 30-second TV spot that could have worked just fine on broadcast TV. But, yay for advertising agencies, they realized that there was something different about it if they stuck it in a conversational medium. So yes, fine, they just took a TV spot and they stuck it on YouTube, but the great thing that happened after that was when they did the response campaign and they started targeting all these micro communities all around the web, and they sent Alyssa Milano flowers and started messing around with Reddit and 4chan. Very interesting experience trying to get P&G to understand what 4chan is. apparently the key to that is to not tell them and then do it anyway. So you've got stuff like this, which is an interesting experiment. Well done there. You've got stuff that Berg do. The wonderful Swapu kind of concept stuff that they've been doing with toys as media objects. You know, how do we create these networked objects that are a bit like background TV and that can tell stories that way? We've got the stuff that I mentioned earlier, the Rahm Emanuel story of the epic kind of comic book story on Twitter. You've got another Tom Armitage example. So Tom put together these bots that kind of implement a state machine. So they just talk to each other on Twitter. So Bill will say, cover me, and then Louis will say, bag another, and then you've got this kind of drama playing out. And it's really nice that you're able to do that kind of stuff on Twitter. One more example, you've got stuff like the Mongoliad, which is Neil Stephenson, who has still proved that he doesn't need an editor and he will just keep writing until he dies. But this is something that he's doing with Greg Bear, where he's kind of going full bore into the whole universe creation thing and has decided that ultimately what he just needs to do is just produce his own wiki that you pay for. Then you have things in the music arena. So you've got stuff like Nine Inch Nails did with something called Year Zero, where they also created this kind of alternate reality game experience around that, where it wasn't just the music, but it was a thing that you could go to and also be a part of that wasn't necessarily just a gig. And then you also have things like Glitch, which are also kind of like more webby versions of something like World of Warcraft. These are all very nice, but they are not necessarily the kind of interconnected, interactive, net native, feel like they're actually part of the net, rather than TV on the web future that I thought I was going to get. In some respects, I thought I was going to get lots of Sherlock Holmes and Inspector Dixon, I think. Anyway, lots of Star Trek and lots of holo novels. That didn't happen. What I'd really, really like to see is this stuff, is something like the Young Lady's Illustrated Primer from Neil Stephenson's The Diamond Age. I think the thing that's going on is that there are some platforms that have made it easier to tell, to produce and publish and discover and curate storytelling than others. So these are the easy ones. So Hilo, obviously, right? We've seen that it was a great example for people to pretend on until they started killing off accounts. YouTube, it doesn't seem to matter so much. You know, you can publish any video on there. They don't really care about who you are. Twitter, again, Tumblr, and then you go down the stack to stuff like WordPress. The thing is that some of these have more attention power than others. So if I publish stuff on, say, YouTube, then, you know, there's a greater chance that what I stick up there is going to be seen by people. Then you've got interesting kind of side things like Extra Normal, which is the kind of movie creation thing that produces stuff like this. I don't know if some of you saw the Hello, I'm a Digital Ninja video that came out, I think, sometime last year. But again, this is kind of like, okay, it helps you create CGI movies that also have text-to-speech in them, but also has a publishing platform built into that. And then at the very, very sharp end of this, you've got something like fanfiction.net, which is very, very much like, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a manuscript and then publish it, and then other people who are into those types of things are going to see it. And then we've got the hard ones. These are the ones where it seems to be really, really difficult to produce some sort of storytelling or entertainment experience that is narrative-based, right? So you try creating characters and then telling a story on something like Facebook or Google Plus, where it's hard enough to be a real human, never mind a fake human, presumably because these services are completely based around knowing everything about a real person's identity so that they can sell that person as a product to my day job at an advertising agency. But the thing is that none of these things, to me at the moment, feel necessarily like stacks. Or at least like entertainment stacks that I'm thinking about. Because they don't feel like places where you know what you're going to discover. How would you have found, you know, the one mechanism that it seems like you would have found something like the two mayors, the Rahm Emanuel thing, would have been if someone retweeted it, or if one of your followers, or one of the people that you're following, had found it and then stuck it into your stream. But there doesn't seem to be a space where I can go, you know what, I'm looking for this kind of thing, where can I find it? And the thing about that early example with the ARG for AI back in 2001 was it was completely amorphous. There were no kind of barriers around it. It just spread across the whole net, and you wouldn't really know where it would start and where it would finish, which leads to massive, massive problems for discoverability and, frankly, you know, also massive problems for the number of people who will actually participate in that kind of entertainment. So none of these feel like stacks. We also don't, it doesn't necessarily feel like we have the right kind of authoring tools. So all the people who are producing fiction on Twitter, are pretty much just doing it by hand at the moment, or they might use something like Hootsuite, but there isn't something specifically designed for, you know, if I want to tell a story with multiple characters over a stream-based social network, how am I going to be able to do that? Is there an interesting way for me to do that other than just setting up a whole bunch of accounts and being very, very diligent about my timekeeping? And it strikes me that one of the big root causes of this is about the last 30 years worth of history. Because what we've ultimately done is we've just reduced everything down to ones and zeros from a content point of view. You know, so as soon as we started digitizing all of this stuff, they're all just the same. You know, the ones and zeros, it doesn't matter whether it's a photo, it doesn't matter whether it's an MP3 or music or video, whatever. They're all exactly the same. So from a user interface point of view, these are all just files. And it's down to the icon design that I get to tell what is what and what kind of thing is what kind of thing. And then, you know, we come to something like a number of years later that's more than 10. and then Lion comes out, right? And then it seems like the greatest advance that we have, other than something like CoverFlow, right, which is essentially really big icons, is this new thing on the left, which is all of my files and then just categories. So I can find all of my images or all of my PDFs and stuff like that. And it feels like we lost a lot of stuff when we started digitizing things because we didn't really think about how we were going to represent them. Or at least we took the easiest path. We took the path of least resistance and we said, well, we're storing them all in a file system, so essentially we just display them as objects in a file system. And the file system treats everything pretty much the same, so we're okay. But, you know, if I show this to you, then you've got a pretty good idea of what content this thing holds. Apart from if you think about it too much, because it could be music or it could be data. So it's a bad example. As is this, which is mainly, you know, this is probably a movie or a TV show, unless you're one of those really weird people who bought that thing that plugs into a VHS, and you could back up your hard drive to a VHS tape, which is fucked up. but I think we can all agree that we know, when we see one of these, we know what it is and what's on it, and the qualia of the thing. And the thing that concerns me when we're talking about, okay, well, what do we need to do if we want to build a full stack for entertainment, is that when we end up looking at all of these things, they all kind of look the same to me. They don't get across that these are very different types of content, right? So we've got YouTube, we've got Spotify, we've got iPlayer, iPlayer Radio, ITV Player, we've got Amazon, Twitter, iTunes. We don't really need to talk about iTunes. We can just take it as read that iTunes is bad. And stuff like Amazon Cloud Reader as well. And I think this is one of the things that's been touched on earlier today, is that we all love stuff like this. And the wonderful promise of this was that it is a magic window. We can put anything that we want in this. And it can show us anything we want. It can be something that lets us watch TV shows or lets us play games, lets us look at photos, lets us do email. But right now, they kind of look like the same thing. And it strikes me that we live in a really weird world where a book looks like something that is no wider than 255 pixels. Because that's what a book is now. Or that's what a book looks like, not what it is. And that it's weird that a TV show or a movie is something that looks about 640 pixels wide, irrespective of the metadata that I might be reading about it. That's what it looks like. They all look like thumbnails now, and they don't really tell me what they are. I have to think a lot more about all the stuff that I've got in Frank's, quite frankly, large piles. There we are. So the big thing is, like, where are all of our cues? So you look at stuff like what McSweeney's are doing. So McSweeney's is a really interesting kind of, it's a publishing house. It puts out a website. It has an app. It produces books. It produces quarterly magazines, that kind of thing. It's interesting to try and work out, you know, what is it about this that makes me understand what I'm looking at or what I'm putting, what I'm getting myself into in terms of the content experience that I'm going to have. So I don't really think that this is a metadata problem. It's not like, I don't really think this is the kind of thing where, in the strictest sense, you know, we have our thumbnail and we just describe it more in text. This isn't really kind of like that kind of database problem where we go, well, okay, I'll just show you a thumbnail of everything like iTunes or a nice cover flow interface. And then you need to work out and you need to try and remember what it is that you're looking at, whether it's a TV show, a movie, or a piece of music. And the thing is, that leads us to stuff like this. And it kind of explains why Apple keeps going to back to skeuomorphic design every now and then. Because, yes, this is terrible, but we know what an address book is. And we're not going to mistake an entry in an address book for a thing that's just another file. And perhaps this is one of the promises that direct manipulation on something like a touchscreen device or a multi-touch device is going to help us with. And when we're thinking about the types of apps that Apple is asking us to make, when they're abstracting away the file system, when they're saying, look, forget about files. What are the actual things that we are dealing with now, and not the, you know, 64 by 64 pixel representations of those things that all have to look like icons? And then we end up with really nice stuff like this, which is, well, we can take all that stuff, and now we can also physically instantiate it now. So that thing that looks like just any other podcast could well be this thing that Russell Davis made, which is a tin can that is the In Our Time tin can. Now, it's the one thing that does this thing, and I know that that tin can does In Our Time. And I said that in my talk description, I said that I would try and talk about, you know, who are the kinds of people who are trying to figure this out. And it's going to sound a bit kind of Apple fanboyish and apologist, but the really interesting thing to me from a lot of Steve Jobs' keynotes has been when he does this bit. And he says that the thing that's important about Apple is that it's the bit that stands in the middle between liberal arts and technology. It's not just about the feature set, but it's about helping people helping people create. You know, that quote where Steve Jobs says that the computer should be like a bicycle for the mind. It should be a force multiplier for the stuff that you want to be able to do. And you shouldn't be figuring out all this stuff like, I can't remember which kind of file or where I've put that file. And I think key to figuring this kind of stuff out is for people like us to be able to collaborate with other types of people. And the thing that I'd like to end on is this quote that Steve said in an interview at one of the digital, I think it was the D1 conference. And he's talking about Pixar. And he's talking about how traditionally the technical people, the engineering people, never really talked to the creative people. Or that they had this, he got to see it in the position that he was in. He got to see that Hollywood had a really, really disdainful, obviously, attitude towards all the geeks in Silicon Valley. Because they were like, those guys are just coming up with technology. They don't understand creativity. They didn't think or don't think that coders or developers or designers work in the same way that they do, especially coders. And at the same time, you'd have the people in Silicon Valley saying, you know what, all these creative people, they just sit around all day and then they just come up with an idea and then maybe that's just it. You know, it's not that hard work to put together a movie. But then when Steve tried to smush these two people together, these two types of people together in an organization like Pixar, then it's telling that he says that one of his greatest achievements is being able to get those two types of people to work together. So I think that's probably the most important thing in terms of figuring out how we build this stack, is how we figure out how to collaborate with other people. Thanks very much.